This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of plantyourself.com. When you think about what's the scariest disease that you could possibly be diagnosed with, and what's the disease in which more money and effort and breakthrough cures are being chased than any other, I think we'd have to agree that it's cancer. So when I saw that the Wellness Forum Health Conference coming up in November, first weekend in November 2016, includes Tom Seyfried and T. Colin Campbell, I got really excited. Now, T. Colin Campbell I know well because I collaborated with him on his second book, Whole, and his third book, The Low Carb Fraud. And of course, he's known for his first book, The China Study, in which he lays out the case that animal protein is the single most significant carcinogen in our diets, and that if we want to avoid cancer, then we can do so by eating a largely plant-based diet. Tom Seyfried, I didn't know that well until I was introduced to his work by Dr. Pam Popper, who is president and founder of Wellness Forum Health. And Dr. Popper is our guest on today's show. Seyfried's work is based on what's called the metabolic theory of cancer, which is opposite, in many ways, the genetic theory, which is the one that most of us grew up hearing about, and it's the one that drives almost all of the cancer therapies. And Seyfried has amassed a great deal of research in a textbook that discusses this idea that cancer is not caused by genetic defects or genetic attacks on our genes, but that all of the genetic consequences follow something else. And that something else is what's known as the metabolic theory of cancer. So here we had, at the same conference for the first time, these two giants of cancer research, T. Colin Campbell and Thomas Seyfried. And as I said, I got really excited. And so I called up Dr. Pam Popper, who is the mastermind of this meeting, and I happen to know that she has been wangling for this for a long time, for these two great minds who have done very, very similar work and work that could really inform the others, but had never met. And they're going to be speaking at the same conference, they're going to be sitting at the same table at meals, and the rest of us are all going to benefit from that collaboration and melding of minds. So I wanted to talk with Dr. Popper about what that means. So we get into a conversation about cancer, about what it is, about how bad it is, about how current treatments are essentially ineffective or worse. And then we go off into the theories of cancer and how the works of Drs. Campbell and Seyfried really can inform each other and can inform us so that we can prevent cancer. And if we happen to find ourselves with it or a loved one with it, we can take the best steps towards reversing it, or, as Dr. Popper says, turning it into a chronic disease that we die with, not of. We also talk about the rest of the conference. In some ways, this is a plea for me, for anyone who's interested in health, to sign up and attend the Wellness Forum Health Conference. We give information about that at the end of the interview, and I also will put it in the show notes, and today will be episode 178. So without further ado, Dr. Pam Popper, welcome back to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Well, it's wonderful to be back. I always have a good time doing these with you.
Yeah. So today we're going to talk about something a little bit different, which is I was looking at the online brochure for the Wellness Forum Health Annual Conference, which is always a fun event. It's always full of great people and great information and great presentations. But this year, it just felt like I looked at these two people who are coming to speak, and all of a sudden I got chills. And the two people are T. Colin Campbell, who's probably known to many listeners of this podcast, and the other is, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, Seyfried or Seyfried?
Yes, Seyfried.
Seyfried. Yeah. Tom Seyfried. And I got chills, and I have a feeling that you have spent many years planning this meeting and bringing it together, and I would love to I think everyone should go to this conference. So I'll say that right up front. This is kind of a blatant pitch to get people to come and hear this information. But I'd love for you, as kind of the architect, the mastermind of the meeting, to kind of explain what its significance is.
Well, there are so many things that are significant about this conference, and none of which you could outline in a brochure that would go on for like 36 pages and who would read it, right? So this is a great opportunity to do that. The first thing is our 20th anniversary conference, and we think these 10-year milestones are huge. It's just, you know, let's face it, it's hard to start a business, and we have the unique situation where, you know, if we still all like each other, and we get along, and we're doing well, and, you know, that's not the story you hear, whether you're in the healthcare business or some other business, you know, so we're real proud of the fact that we're 10 years, you know, another 10 years old, and of course, the first person I called when I was planning this conference was Colin Campbell, and the reason was, he was one of our key presenters at our 10th anniversary conference, and he actually did the toast, and he's doing it for this one too. So there was some history there. I'm a good friend of Colin Campbell's and a great admirer of his, and I've learned so much from him, and we just felt we couldn't have done a 10th anniversary conference without him, and boy, the first person on the agenda to invite was him for the 20th. So that's one thing. It's a big party, and yes, there will be cake. We're going to have a party. We deserve one. But to go to your question about these two people and the significance that they have, And I think let's start with the fact that we recognize the fact that different experts bring different perspectives to the table when we're talking about health, and particularly when we're talking about a complicated issue like cancer. And if you look at Dr. Seyfried, Dr. Campbell, they start with some significant similarities. For example, Dr. Campbell would tell you that cancer is not mostly caused by your genes. It's mostly caused by other things. Dr. Seyfried, his book is about that. Cancer is a metabolic disease. He starts with the idea that he's a geneticist, and he's here to tell you that it's not your genes that are causing your cancer. So there are many, many points of agreement in terms of how these two very important and diligent researchers look at health. And then there are some differences in how they look at health. Seyfried proposes some interesting options like a ketogenic diet that might be an option for some people that have intractable cancers like glioblastoma. Of course, anybody who's read China's study and followed Dr. Campbell for a long time would know that Dr. Campbell would probably never prescribe that for somebody with cancer. But I know that Dr. Campbell is a scientist, and he's interested in hearing the science behind all of this, all the information. So I think that both of these people are going to enjoy listening to each other, and I think the audience is going to enjoy both presentations. And we've already had people say, what do I have to do for you to let me sit at the table where they both are and hear the conversation that they're going to have that will never be delivered from the stage, but will be fascinating nonetheless. And so that's basically it. I could go on and on about all the other things, but I'll just let you ask me questions. But I think that's laying out the premise of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's so fascinating to me is the fact that they're like two different jigsaw puzzle pieces that fit together so interestingly, like not perfectly. Like if they were both into the ketogenic diet, like they would have known of each other, like from two different worlds. But, you know, I think people listening to this don't really understand, wouldn't know Tom Seyfried's work or the whole metabolic theory. Can you kind of give us that in a nutshell and why it's so important?
Yeah, the issue with Dr. Seyfried, a researcher by the name of Otto Warburg in Germany, he was doing a lot of interesting cancer research, and he developed this theory of cancer, which I happen to think is right. And I think that had the circumstances been different during his career, we probably would be using his theory to guide our decisions right now about how to treat cancer. One thing is how to prevent it, and I think Dr. Campbell gives us a great roadmap for that. Stop eating the things that cause cancer. stop engaging in the lifestyle habits that lead to cancer. But once you have it, what actually has happened? And Warburg's theory was that the genetic changes in the cell happen after the cell becomes cancerous. And the cause of cancer is when a cell loses its ability to engage in the right pathways of cellular respiration, and it begins to process fuel abnormally. And that's about the best it can be explained without slides and visuals. But what normally happens is that cells process glucose, and glucose then goes through the Krebs cycle. This is how the body gets energy. And so cellular respiration doesn't refer to how the cell breathes. It refers to how the cell processes macronutrients from food. And when that process goes bad and the cell starts fermenting glucose and other substances in the presence of oxygen, the cell becomes abnormal. And within a very short period of time, it begins to have all the hallmarks of a cancer cell. It loses its ability to commit apoptosis, to off itself, because it's abnormal. It gains unlimited replicability. And there are seven hallmarks of cancer, and the cell adopts all of those. And so the genetic changes follow, not precede those changes. And if we look at that and that whole process, it guides us to some other explanations of how to treat cancer. And Seyfried goes into great detail about all the ways in which traditional cancer treatments like chemotherapy and radiation, and even in many instances surgery, will actually make this process worse and almost guarantee that the patient will die. He even hypothesizes, and I think there's something to it, that one of the reasons that cancer treatments might appear to work in the short term is that they make the patient so sick that the patient can't eat, and the calorie restriction is what is responsible for the effect of positive effect, if there is one, not actually the drug. So then he goes on, well, and let me come back to why aren't we all talking about this? Well, Otto Warburg was a Jewish researcher in Hitler's Germany, and the only reason he wasn't sent to the camps was that Hitler had had a polyp on his vocal cord. He was deathly afraid of developing cancer and figured if he were to develop cancer, he would need all of the bright minds, even the Jewish bright minds, to help him if that happened to him. So that's why Warburg was not sent to the camps. But by the same token, he was not about to publicize any of Warburg's work or hold him up as an example or send him off to conferences. It's my understanding that he was not even able to leave Germany to receive the Nobel Prize because of the situation. So a lot of his work got buried, and while people have talked about it off and on, I think Seyfried's the first person who's written a textbook about it, saying, this is the deal, you guys. We need to pay attention to this. He was right. And if we start to look at all aspects of cancer, from how we get it to how we treat it, it all points back to the fact that Warburg really had nailed it in the late 1930s. We just didn't really focus on it until now.
Mm. Now, you know, people were sort of looking at it, but there was a bunch of studies that supposedly disproved it, right? There were a lot of cell studies, lab culture studies, and so the cancer industry moved into totally different directions. But what were those studies, and what was wrong with them?
Well, the problem with cancer research is that, first of all, we do so much of it in animals, and there's a major problem with doing cancer research in animals, and that is that animals do not experience metastasized cancer naturally, like it happens in humans. So you always have to artificially induce the metastases, which means that you're never going to get a real-life picture of what's going on. The second thing is that it's entirely different to do things in cell cultures, because it's a very isolated environment, whereas cancer cells in a human body, there's so many different exposures. So it's never really the same thing. And so whether you're looking at Warburg's theory or whether you're looking at anybody else's theory of cancer, at some point in time, you're going to have to look at what goes on in real humans. And we don't want to do that here in the United States. I mean, we're happy to do it for drugs. People sign up to be in clinical trials for drugs because the alternatives that they have have don't work and that sort of thing. But we don't seem to be willing to make that same concession to theories like Warburg's, where we say, look, we're going to have to take some, at some point in time, to test our theories about this, we're going to have to take some patients with intractable cancers, like brain cancers, and subject them to varying diets and varying treatments until we figure this thing out. But the studies that purportedly disproved Warburg's theory were not really good ones for disproving his theory. And furthermore, if we were going to discredit every theory of health, whether we're talking about this one or anything else, the ability to come up with a study that says that it isn't true, my gosh, we'd all still be smoking cigarettes, because there are plenty of studies that showed that cigarettes weren't harmful. The problem was that there were just a whole lot more that showed that it was. So I think there's a tendency in the cancer business and in the health business in general to defend profitable theories, to defend the thing that you're invested in. And you can always do it by coming up with a study or two or five that say that you're right, but you know that doesn't necessarily represent the greater body of knowledge that might show that you're wrong.
Mm. So in terms of cancer research and treatments, obviously the genetic model has been the main one. What's some evidence that the genetic model isn't right? Because that's, I mean, you know, when you look at like studies in like PubMed over the last 5 years, you see a lot of doubts about it. But in terms of like the lay public and mainstream media and most doctors, it's like the theory that something happens to your genes and then this rogue cell just starts replicating and eating everything else in its path and kills you is the main theory. What evidence is there that that's not right?
Well, I think the first thing is that we've developed 700 drugs and possible treatments based on the theory of genetics, and only one's worked. That's Gleevec. And when you're talking about one out of 700, you almost want to say something else might be going on, not the actual addressing of the genetic mutation. So it's been largely a failure in terms of coming up with anything that's actually helped anybody. The second thing is, and this is recent information, it's not in anybody's book yet, but I was involved in a class with Dr. Ralph Moss of Cancer Decisions. And he was talking about, he said at the beginning of the class, he said this, he's a big fan of Seyfried's, and he was talking about the Warburg theory for a long time before I ever knew who Seyfried was. But Dr. Moss said, we're never going to come up with a way to treat genetic issues related to cancer. And he cited as an example a study that hasn't been published yet, but soon will be, where tissue samples were taken from a person with non-small lung cancer. And they looked at genetic mutations, and there were over 1,000 of them. And then they took another similar size sample from another cancer patient with the same type of cancer patient. There were also over 1,000 genetic mutations. The problem was it wasn't the same 1,000 genetic mutations that the first patient had. And so this goes to the question of how do you ever develop a drug that will treat millions of variations? You can't. And so it really goes to Seyfried's issue that the cell became, the genetic changes happened afterwards. That's why there are so many. So, and I think, you know, going back to Campbell's work and where the similarities are, I think Colin Campbell made a very strong case in China study that while genes may predispose you to disease states, and there are some people who definitely have been given a bad genetic hand, the vast majority of the time, illness stems from the choices that we make, not genetic predisposition. And so if that's true for heart disease, if it's true for diabetes, and just think about this in terms of diabetes. Some of the work that Neil Barnard and the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, he's another speaker at the conference, by the way, but think about the work that they've done with the Native American population, definitely predisposed to develop diabetes, predictably eat their way out of it in almost every instance. So the genetic theory is not working out in cancer, and it's not working out in other diseases as well. And by the way, there's another book, and one of these days I'm going to have this doctor come and speak too. His name is Mukherjee, Siddhartha Mukherjee, wrote a book called The Emperor of All Maladies, which was the history of cancer. And in that, you learn that the genetic theory of cancer has been visited and discarded on a number of different occasions, as have a lot of other theories about cancer. And they just recirculate every once in a while when all the other stuff that researchers have been looking at doesn't work, and so now let's circle back to something and see if we can make it work this time. So there's been a longer focus, mainly because we know so much more about genes right now, but the idea that genes don't cause cancer been visited and revisited and discarded on numerous occasions.
But if we read the news, we're winning the war on cancer, right? You look at the American Cancer Society statistics and graphs. Like there's all this PR coming at us that says that, you know, the final breakthrough is just around the corner. Like, are we winning the war on cancer?
Not at all. What we've done, what happens in the cancer business is so despicable. It's almost hard for me to talk about it without sounding angry, and I really work these days to not sound like an angry elf because I don't think it helps. but if you look at what goes on in the cancer business, one of the big breakthroughs, I would put air quotes around it if you and I were face to face right now, has been diagnostic testing. We're going to catch the cancer early and treat it before it becomes more serious, which sounds like a great idea, but one of the problems in healthcare and in many other areas of life too is what we call the law of unintended consequences. It sounds like a great idea, but what really happens when you start doing this thing? Well, what's happened is we are indeed catching a lot of cancers early, so early that they're not really cancer. We're just calling them cancer. But we treat it like cancer. We treat the not cancer as if it's cancer. I'm talking about ductal carcinoma in situ, which isn't cancer and doesn't become cancer most of the time. I'm talking about prostate cancer diagnosed through PSA screening. It's not cancer. The false positive rate is 78%. I'm talking about thyroid nodules and minor aberrations and thyroid that get interpreted as cancer. Well, here's what's happened. The first thing is all this diagnostic testing and catching it early, air quotes around that, hasn't changed the death rate from any of these cancers. So we're treating a lot more people. We're just not keeping anybody from dying. And what we have done is we've taken a lot of people who didn't have cancer and we've treated them as if they do, chews up a lot of money. The diagnostic testing that's useless chews up a lot of money. The treatment that people don't need chews up a lot of money. And it kills a lot of people who didn't have anything wrong with them in the first place. But for the vast majority who survived the treatment and the surgeries and all that sort of thing, we now take the person who never had cancer and in whom we invested a lot of money treating them for the cancer they didn't have, we call that person a survivor. And then we build stories and movements around the survivors, air quotes around that, like the Race for the Cure and the pink chicken buckets and the pink M&Ms. And, you know, we create movements around these that make it seem like we're doing so well. And, you know, the statistics can be manipulated, as you know, to tell whatever version of the story you want to tell. And it's being done in cancer. And a lot of people are unwitting pawns in this game. And I know that this sounds really cynical. And I don't want to sound like a cynic, but I do want to tell the truth. And unfortunately, telling the truth about these kinds of things causes you to be labeled as controversial, a label I'm willing to deal with. But I just find it interesting that when we actually point out what's really going on and that we're not making any progress, that becomes a very controversial conversation. But it's one that we need to have, and it's one that the public really needs to be aware of, because the public is investing a lot of money through taxpayer dollars and through donations to organizations like the American Cancer Society and the Susan Komen Foundation in what really is smoke and mirrors and an enormous amount of effort and money spent harming more than helping many people.
All right. And I guess the latest was this week, Ben Stiller, right, announced that, you know, he'd had his cancer detected by PSA at age 48. And so he's urging people to not listen to the guidelines of the National Preventive Health. Like, you know, if he'd waited 2 years, God knows what would have happened to his cancer.
Oh my gosh, he'd probably still not, he wouldn't be incontinent and suffering from erectile dysfunction and have all of his body parts intact. We'd hate to see that. There's no money in that.
Right. Well, I think I guess Gilbert Welch's book, one of his books, he talks about sort of the game theory that there's no downside to being screened for the individual as far as they know. Right. Because if you're screened and they don't find anything, you're relieved and you tell everyone, oh, go get screened for peace of mind. And if you get screened and they find something, whether they should have found it or not, then you say, thank God they found it. So there's only perceptual upsides to the screening.
Well, and the problem is people do not know. I mean, you know, our business is focused on informed medical decision making, because if the consumer knew all of this that we're talking about, the demand for healthcare services, most of what we do in healthcare, would be severely diminished. And so the medical institutions can't tell you the truth about this stuff because they go into a gradual process of liquidation. So somebody outside has to tell you the truth about this stuff. And fortunately, the number of voices that are discussing this type of information are getting more in number. And I really do see a time in the future when a lot of this is going to go away, not because medicine takes responsibility for it, it's just too profitable, but because consumers just stop saying okay to what's offered to them.
Mm. So there was one drug. I mean, there's a lot of drugs that are based on the genetic theories that are developed that, you know, doctors will say, well, we should give this will increase your lifespan by 33%, which sounds really good. But that's not necessarily accurate, right?
Well, another way that statistics get manipulated is we focus on things like surrogate markers. A drug that shrinks tumors in the cancer business, you know, is considered good. But what the real outcome is survival. In other words, if you ask somebody, are you interested in smaller tumors or living to 100? Would you live with tumors if and just leave them there if you could live to be 100? Most people would opt for that. And by the way, that's one of Saferide's proposals, is that and it's the way that I've always, you know, advised cancer patients, is that in some cases we don't want to get rid of the cancer because we're going to get rid of the patient in the process of getting rid of the cancer. In some situations, cancer could become a chronic condition that you die with and not of. I mean, people die with type 1 diabetes. They don't necessarily have to die of it. And so it could be the case with a cancer, with certain types of cancer, if they were treated differently, not with radiation and chemotherapy and surgery, for example. So with cancer drugs, what you see is you'll see things like 33%. Well, if your survival was going to be 6 months and you survive for 8 months, that's 33% increase in survival, but were you really looking for 8 months of survival? Probably not. Another thing that you see is disease progression-free survival. And so the cancer goes dormant for a while after the treatment, but the date that you die is the same regardless. You're not increasing survival in both of those examples. And what people are really looking for, sometimes they're not very good at expressing it when they come into the oncologist's office or any other doctor's office, they're looking for a long life, a long, basically healthy life. They're not looking for an extra 2 months. They're not looking for just a smaller tumor. Same thing in other diseases. People like to have low cholesterol, but what they really don't want to do is have a heart attack or die. You know, so low cholesterol is just a benchmark for looking at your risk. It's not the actual condition, but we focus all of our efforts on do anything to ratchet the cholesterol down, including a drug that doesn't change your risk of heart attack. So that's where the misunderstandings are. People I call it drinking the medical Kool-Aid. They buy the idea that these drugs are beneficial, when if they actually saw the hard data, they wouldn't do many of the things that are proposed to them.
Right. Now, so a cancer drug can get approved by the FDA just for shrinking a tumor when there's no benefit to the patient?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's so, I'll tell you how bad it is. When von Eschenbach was head of the FDA, he approved Avastin, which was originally approved for colon cancer, for breast cancer treatment. It didn't extend life by a single day. It costs $100,000. Now, we can get angry with insurance companies all day long, but one of the problems we have with insurance companies and the way that we deal with them is when you ask insurance companies to pay $100,000 for a drug that doesn't extend your life by a single day, you can see why they get a little prickly about these things. And the day, by the way, that happened, Genentech stock was worth like $6 billion more dollars because of all the people who would then sign up to get this treatment. So it doesn't even have to extend your life at all. in some instances. We use some pretty strange criteria for deciding what we're going to approve. And by the way, I've written a lot about this lately. The FDA approved 94% of the drugs submitted for approval or for additional uses, and 99% of devices. And one of the reasons is that the FDA is largely funded by drug and device makers. The drug companies so far this year in 2016, remember, we're just early October, have paid the FDA $718 million. That's what finances three-fifths of the FDA's budget. So essentially what's happened is the FDA has become an employee of the drug companies. I don't know how else to look at it. And so FDA approved doesn't mean it's a good idea, doesn't mean it's safe, doesn't mean it's effective. It means that employees of the drug companies have said, okay to sell. And I'm only half joking when I say one of these days, and it won't be too far off, the drug companies are just going to send the FDA a memo saying, you know, just going to give you a heads up. You know, we're putting a new drug out there in a couple weeks, probably going to kill a few people, hurt a few people. You'll be hearing about it, but we thought we ought to notify you before we do it. I mean, we're not that far from it right now.
Wow. Okay. So back to Seyfried, right?
And Seyfried, yeah.
Seyfried.
I'm sure he'll answer you. We'll call him Tom. How about
Tom,
that?
Okay.
Much easier.
They're both Toms, I guess. Campbell.
Yeah, that's right.
Campbell's
that's
first
right.
name is T, right? So he proposes this ketogenic diet, which is based on the idea that the cells, these cancerous cells, are injured in their ability to use fuel for energy, and therefore we're going to deprive them of all carbohydrates, right? So,
well, it's a little more complicated than that. The first thing I want to say is that that's just one of his proposals. And so I think what happens sometimes when people get all, I've always said, please read the book before you start screaming at me about it. So I have people were sending me all capital letters. Can you believe this guy's proposing a ketogenic diet for cancer?
Well, his book is also
like 400 pages long. How about you read all 400 pages and then let's talk about it.
It's also really hard to read. It's a very, very dense scientific book, and it's also like $100. So.
Yeah, I know. I loved reading it, and I did some advanced study classes for my concierge members because it is a hard to read book. But the point is that he recommends the ketogenic diet as one option, and the basis for it, by the way, is that if you look at the history of ketogenic diets, and so much misinformation is out there about these diets, the ketogenic diet has been used successfully by particularly the dietitians at Johns Hopkins instituted this plan to help epileptic children. And one of the reasons that it works is that it mimics long-term fasting. Like, you can't take a three-year-old and fast that child. You can't fast them for a week, let alone for 2 or 3 years, in order to cure the epilepsy. But if you can put the child in a fasting state, which a ketogenic diet will do if it's done properly, that's how the epilepsy goes away. And I'm simplifying things here just to, you know, make sure that everybody can understand who listens to this. So Seyfried's, he goes in a lot of detail in his book about how calorie restriction works and how fasting, water-only fasting, can work for cancer. And I've sent a lot of patients to True North to do water-only fasting who have cancer. The reason why it works is because cancer cells are really, really smart, but they're actually not very strong at all. And historically, humans have had to live for long periods of time without food, so our normal cells are very adept at surviving in the absence of food, and they can live on ketones for fuel. Cancer cells can't. And so there are all kinds of ways that fasting can be used. Fasting can be used to potentiate small doses of chemotherapy. I've seen that done with some of our members, by the way, who had very serious cancers. You could not simply eat and get better. And I think that's part of the resistance to Seyfried's ideas, is thinking that all you have to do is adopt a plant-based diet and all problems go away. And that's not true. And we're practicing reductionism when we claim that. But Anyway, I've seen calorie restriction and intermittent fasting used to potentiate small doses of chemotherapy having a big impact. And then the possibility that for somebody who has, for example, a glioblastoma, maybe that person goes on a ketogenic diet and turns that into a chronic rather than a fatal condition. You don't necessarily get rid of the cancer, but you keep it from growing, and you don't die if you keep it from growing. And so I was teaching a class the other night, and students were having a great deal of resistance to this idea, as you might imagine. And they said, but yes, I've read all these books about plant-based nutrition, and think of the cholesterol level that these brain cancer patients are going to have. I said, listen, I think if the choice is be alive and taking a statin drug or being dead by Christmas, a lot of cancer patients might say, I think I'm going to take the living route and do that ketogenic diet. So I'm giving you a lot of information and perhaps going beyond the actual question that you asked, but these are complex, complicated issues. And we don't have a program, and we have no evidence to suggest that diet alone would fix something like a glioblastoma, which most certainly kills all patients within a very short period of time. So we have to look beyond this and look at some other options, and they are not necessarily the best options. They're the best of the ones we have available. We have some reason to believe that some of them would be successful, and particularly when used in combination with other treatments, comprehensive strategies, we could perhaps have more success with these patients. And I think we just have to become open-minded when we're talking about people who will most certainly die unless we open our minds and try some new things.
And just to be clear, a ketogenic diet, it has to be sort of a meat-based diet, or...
It's a fat-based diet. The most important thing is that it's mostly fat, and it has to be exactly calibrated. You have some crazy people out there saying, well, I eat a paleo diet and it's ketogenic, or I'm eating an Atkins diet and it's ketogenic. I send everybody who's going to do a ketogenic diet, whether it's for an epileptic 3-year-old or a cancer patient who's going to die soon, to Johns Hopkins, because every single thing has to be measured. I mean, when you're talking about children, eating a cracker messes it up for 2 days. Okay, so this idea that people eating animal foods based on the paleo or Atkins plan have somehow put themselves on a ketogenic diet, it's just laughable. You have to learn how to do this from experts. It has to be done very specifically, but the key thing is you're going to live on fat, and that's what makes everybody so touchy about this who comes from an orientation of plant-based nutrition, because everything that everybody's heard, and it's true, if you're talking about heart disease and diabetes and that sort of thing, you should eat a low-fat diet. If you're talking about preventing cancer, you should eat a low-fat diet. We're talking about what do you do for the poor dude who's got the glioblastoma. We're finished talking about prevention, and we don't have anybody who's ever shown that eating an Esselstyn-style diet is going to make it go away. So what are you going to do for this person? And I think it's time for us to leave all of our dogma behind, whether you're a cancer researcher or a plant-based diet advocate, and say we have to open our minds to some other ideas here.
Right. So it sounds like a ketogenic diet is a way to selectively to attack the body and cancer in a place where the body is likely to win.
Right.
As opposed to like just doing... chemotherapy with like mustard gas or, you know, whatever the origins were, where, you know, it's sort of like destroy the village to save the village.
Well, and he says in the book, Seyfried says in the book, he explains how it will actually kill the patient faster. And so since they all die, you know, I guess and this is the sad part, the saddest part, it's unethical to withhold treatment from patients that is considered the standard of care, even if it has no hope of saving them. But since the patients are all going to die, then why not do something different and see if we can make some progress? Unfortunately, where this will come from, and the reason, coming back to the way you started this, everybody should attend this conference. Everybody should attend this conference because this will never come from this willingness to try, come from the medical field. Drug companies have too much invested in selling expensive drugs that don't help. So what's going to happen is individual patients, and remember last year's conference, we had Kelly Turner talking about radical remission, the 1,000 cancer patients who saved themselves because they stepped outside of the norm to do things differently. Well, if this is going to come from patients who have terminal cancer saying, I have nothing to lose, I'm going to try something different. Now I have an idea of things I could try. I'm going to go find some people who can help me with this. So we need to get the word out. And that's really, I mean, you know, when I talk about cake and 20th anniversary, of course, I love my company and we want to celebrate. But the real thing, the reason we put these conferences on is so that we can get a few hundred people in a room who we think collectively can go tell a few thousand, who can tell a few million, and we can change this healthcare mess that we're in.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's going to be a very, very powerful experience. I mean, I guess, you know, the thing that is counterintuitive when you read the China study and you see the bulk of T. Colin Campbell's work is that, you know, animal foods turn on cancer. And so therefore, how can an animal food diet, you know, I guess lard based diet, really, you know, help with cancer? But it's sort of, if we use the analogy of like chemotherapy, like people use chemotherapy when you have cancer, you know, because it's, you're trying to kill the cancer, you wouldn't say, well, people should just be doing chemotherapy their whole lives.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And it really isn't the animal food, it's the fat. And the goal is to put the person in a fasting state. It's not that the food is curative in this case. It's the fasting state that the food creates that's curative. And that's a big difference. And again, it goes to why it's so important to hear people out and to read what they're talking about and to understand it fully before you start making a comment. And we've seen this, by the way, the same type of criticism has been leveled against Dr. Campbell, and I say the same thing about him. Please read the whole China study and then call me and we'll talk about it. Because when you're sitting there telling me Campbell did an experiment or did an observational study in China and then he started telling everybody to eat a plant-based diet, he specifically says that's not what happened in the book, right? So it's so much stuff taken out of context because people get so upset about things before they have an opportunity to really understand the totality of it. One other thing I'll mention is throughout the book, Seyfried talks about, he does not talk about a plant-based diet, but he makes several references to things that point to a plant-based diet. One of the things he says, for example, is that when the cell starts respiring improperly, it looks for alternative fuel. And one of the best sources of fuel for a cancer cell early stage conversion is plasma cholesterol. Well, he doesn't come out and say, eat a plant-based diet, but where are we getting the cholesterol? It's not from the broccoli. It's from the animal foods. And so, again, I think that if people just listen to the whole thing, everything everybody has to say at the conference, and because everybody mingles around and gets to talk to the speakers, and, of course, I get the best seat. I pick them up at the airport. I get to talk at the dinner table with them. So I am the person who gets the best seat in the house. But everybody will get a chance to interact with both of these people. And I think if they just hear it out, they'll find that I don't think that these individuals are going to disagree with each other on many things. And I think that they don't know each other, by the way. They know of each other. They're both looking forward to meeting each other. Dr. Seyfried's never spoken at a conference for us before, so he's looking forward to knowing more about what we do. And, of course, one thing that we usually have come out of these collaborations conferences is often collaborations with the speakers. And, in fact, we're going to be announcing a very huge and exciting collaboration with Dr. Peter Bregan, who's also presenting at this conference. Remember, he was a speaker in 2012.
Yeah, you know,
he's a business partner, right?
we've got to spend a couple of minutes at the end of this talking about the other speakers.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put a little note to myself to remember to do that. If Dr. Campbell and Seyfried, like, they're both scientists first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And I know, in working with Dr. Campbell on whole, that he really doesn't care about, like, you know, is it vegan or is it, you know, he just wants to know what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that, you know, that those two minds working together are just going to spark all sorts of curiosities.
Exactly. And then we can all learn from each other and it all gets better from there. I mean, you know, Dr. Bregan and I don't agree on everything. We agree on most things. I mean, enough agreement that we can be business partners. And I think if we make the mistake of thinking that we have to go out and find people who we can go line by line through our entire protocol and everything else, and we're only going to take those who are 100%. Well, we're going to have a pretty lonely world, you know.
Right.
We've got to find the places where we can agree and collaborate. So, I think that I'm looking for an incredible weekend, and I'm also looking for incredible things to follow the incredible weekend. And that's been our experience in the past. We've brought a lot of wonderful people together, and they've collaborated with each other and with us in doing some pretty great things.
Yeah. And the other thing I want to say that's a benefit of the conference that was very subtle. It wasn't obvious to me until it really smacked me in the face is last year when Richard Ablin spoke. And here's a guy who spent the last 45 years, a lonely voice in the wilderness, saying that the test that he discovered, basically the PSA, is worthless as a prostate cancer screening device. And I think for the first time in his life, there was a group of people who listened and appreciated and applauded. And that we saw it turned him into putty. One of the things that Wellness Forum Health does is it brings together people who appreciate and validate the work of these unsung heroes.
Exactly. Exactly. And brings the message to people. The hard part is if you're Richard Ablin at the University of Arizona and you're Colin Campbell up at Cornell, and you know, you have to write books and you have to find avenues like Wellness Forum Health to get your message out, because you get drowned out by the people and organizations who have so much more money and power than you do. And by the way, that's not said to make anybody feel that we're helpless and we can't do something about it. The point is, we can do something about it. We are doing something about it. We are not helpless victims here, but we have to get together and learn this stuff and then go tell the others. My mission, my directions to everybody at the end of a conference or the end of a class I teach is now go tell the others. Everybody needs to know about this stuff. And when we get to the place where we have 25, 30 million people in this country who understand what you and I are talking about, that's the tipping point. It's going to be game over for the powers that be when we get to that point, because the system is so precarious that it will collapse within itself. If you withdraw even 10 million people from the system as it is right now, it can't withstand that financial hit. So we're pretty powerful. I'm feeling pretty powerful these days about what we're doing and the direction it's going. And part of it is bringing these unsung heroes, as you call them, to the front center attention, so people can see what's going on behind the scenes. It's actually much more important than what they're told every day by the media.
Great. So circling back to Seyfried and Campbell one last time, What did they have? What do you see in what they have each contributed that can help, you know, collectively, globally, humanity?
Well, I think the message from Dr. Campbell is that cancer is not inevitable. We know what causes a lot of cancer, not all of it, a lot of it, most of it, and so you don't have to get it. That's the best thing. I mean, if you talk to anybody who's got an intractable, incurable cancer, what they really want is to not have the cancer at all. Well, if you're listening to this or you're coming to our conference and you don't have cancer, you know, this is the roadmap for doing your best to prevent cancer. I think the message that Seyfried brings to the table is a greater understanding of the cause of cancer. I mean, the actual metabolic changes, cellular changes that happen. And that is very instructive in terms of, A, why our traditional, conventional approach to cancer is not working, and he proposes options that have some chance to work. And he's going to talk to us about some of the research that he's been doing that followed the book and some of his research findings. So we have two people who are showing you how to not get cancer, and then if you have it or someone you care about has it, some options that you might want to consider. And that becomes very important, because for many of these people, there aren't any viable options that they know about. Well, there are actually viable options. They're just not talked about in traditional places.
Right. Now, Dr. Campbell goes into great detail around things like that, you know, mixed function oxidase and you know, protein metabolism and how cancer comes about. But he never goes to the cellular, you know, the level of the mitochondria, the way Seyfried does. Do you think that there's something in in a combination of those two approaches that could really help explain like why plant-based foods can prevent cancer from happening in the first place? Because I don't think we really know that.
Well, yeah, but Seyfried does say that. He says that an assault on cells, regardless of where it comes from, if it's repeated enough, will damage them. Okay, so where is the damage coming from? He actually lists it in the book: diet, pollution, chemicals, smoking. You know, really mostly lifestyle. He at no point in time does he say in the book, "This is just bad luck." He clearly, at least what I read in the book, he clearly sees that there is a cause and effect relationship between the way we live and the cancers that we get or don't get. Oh my gosh, I apologize for that noise. It's the garbage truck coming down my street.
That's right. It's a good metaphor for preventing cancer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, if the Worthington Sanitation Department didn't stop working.
Yeah, we would have terrible problems if they were not picking stuff up today.
All right, I mean, people should come just to hear those two guys and to hear them, you know, talk to each other and think and see the new research directions that they're gonna push. You mentioned Neil Barnard is also speaking. What's he going to
do? And he was also at our 10th anniversary, and we have a lot to celebrate with Neil. Full disclosure, I'm on the President's Board for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, so this is not an entirely arm's-length situation. But PCRM has accomplished a lot in recent years, and in areas that are really important, such as the elimination of the use of animals in medical training. I've always used this example. You know, if your child was choking, do you want the doctor who intubates your child to have practiced on cats or something that looks like a human? And almost everybody says, I think I would go for the mannequin that looks like a human. So the inadvisability of using animals in medical training is so compelling that 100% of all medical schools in the United States have eliminated it. 100%. That's an amazing statistic. So that's been accomplished. And then the studies that PCRM has done on diabetes and weight gain, neuropathy, migraine, rheumatoid arthritis, and of course the opening of the Barnard Medical Center, which is a great model for how healthcare should be practiced. And I think Dr. Barnard's real goal is to see more of these types of centers, either with his name on it or not, opened around the country. Again, apologize for the noise now there in front of my house. But so that's what he's going to talk about. And then, of course, Dr. Bragan is coming back to talk about the inadvisability of using psychiatric drugs to treat patients with psychological disorders. In 50 years of practice, he's never prescribed a drug, never institutionalized a patient, and never had a completed suicide on his watch, and it was a remarkable track record. And he's going to talk about a lot of the work that he's done, another unsung hero, by the way, to remedy this situation. I mean, people don't realize this is the guy who's been the expert witness in the trials that have led to huge damage awards for little children who've been damaged for life by taking antipsychotic drugs at the age of 3 and that sort of thing, and who's analyzed the data as it was submitted to the FDA and shown that the drug should never have been approved. And then, of course, we'll talk about what we're doing. We're developing a mental health program at Wellness Forum Health, both through our school to train mental health professionals and help train professionals to withdraw people from the drugs, because 25% of the people in the country take the drugs. We have close to 100 million people that have to be taken off these drugs just in the United States. And then mental health care is delivered through the healthcare company with trained therapists who don't use drugs. So lots to talk about there. And then, of course, Dr. Janice Fanger is a favorite always. She gives very well-researched presentations. This one will be on diet and pregnancy. And Dr. Von Lanthen, Mariel Von Lanthen, who will be talking about diet and reflux. And by the way, the reason why you might notice we try to bring in some other topics. I love when we talk about diabetes and heart disease, but, you know, most of what we're seeing in our office is a combination of a whole lot of other things, so we have to cover those conditions too. So Dr. Von Lanthen and Dr. Stanger bring to the table a discussion about conditions that we should be paying as much attention to as we do cancer and diabetes and heart disease.
And I will say this about, you know, Peter Breggin, when you had recommended some of his work, and my expectation when you recommend a book is that it's always going to be sort of scientifically based, evidence-based. And so I was expecting, you know, a kind of a dry read a little bit, like he's going to explain like why psychiatric drugs don't work and this and that. And I found one of his books called The Heart of Healing.
Oh, it's a fabulous book.
And like, I wasn't expecting to stay up reading a medical book and weeping.
I know. Well, I'll tell you how amazing Peter Breggin is. I mean, I always focus on the drugs and the whole thing because that's really a huge medical problem that we have. But he's an amazing, amazing therapist. And I think the statement I'm going to make right now says it all. You and I both know Eileen Capsaptis, who is our physical therapy guru in New York, upstate New York.
Yep.
And she will be there also. She's designed a training program to clone her, which we need to have about 1,000 Eileens in the country. Anyway, we were talking about Peter Breggin one day, and Eileen said, I'm not that far away from him. I wish there was something wrong with me so I could go have a few sessions with him.
Right, I pay good
she
money.
Said, I don't want to take somebody else's time and say, I just want to pay you so I can spend time with you. I wouldn't do that. But she said, it almost makes you wish you were depressed so you could call and make an appointment. And it's true.
Yeah.
He and his wife both are such delightful people. I mean, Del and I went to Ithaca to spend a couple days with them when we started the discussion about this project that we're doing now. And I hated to leave. It's like, you know, maybe we could hang out for another week and we'll just have our work sent here. But spending time with him is a remarkable experience. That book is indicative of the way that he approaches helping people. And I don't think I've ever met a person, a therapist or otherwise, who has such an empathic approach to other people. He just loves people and he relates to everybody, and he cares about everybody, and he doesn't think anybody's a hopeless case. I watched a video that he showed me when we were in Ithaca, where he was talking to the suicidal patient, and he said, the first thing is, let's look at the bright side. If you're thinking of committing suicide, you care. If you care, there's hope. And I watched him, this message delivered as he looked right into the camera, and I thought, oh my gosh, if every suicidal patient saw this video, they would not head for the bridge. Because he just instills hope and hope in everybody. And so anyway, I can't say enough good things about him, and I feel like the luckiest girl in the world that he wants to be our business partner.
Right. And just a personal story. So, you know, I've been to several conferences, and I've met Eileen Capsaptis, the physical therapy guru we're trying to clone. So in January, I found myself limping badly from my right knee. And I had no idea what was going on, but I couldn't do martial arts. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't squat. It hurt to sit. And I said, well, I'm not going to go, you know, I'm not going to go to like Albany, New York to like three times a week for several months, but I need an Eileen down here. So I emailed her and I said, here's the situation. And I was looking at all the physical therapists, and there's like 100 different physical therapy offices, and they all offer different stuff. And I was like, I don't know enough to find one. And she looked around and she says, oh, look, there's one. It's like an hour away. Like, this guy's really good. Do this. And I started, that was in January. I started in like February, and I just finished a 50K. And
oh, like, wonderful.
With her help and advice and guidance, I was able to find the one physical therapy office in my state. Really, that is
totally, yes, she's wonderful.
Evidence-based.
She is just wonderful.
And so, you know, I have a lot to be thankful for having the Wellness Forum Health resources at my fingertips.
Well, that's why I love what I do. And that's now we're back to why we're going to celebrate 20 years of this, right? And think of really hundreds of thousands of people worldwide who we've touched sometimes in very minor ways, but sometimes in real profound ways. I mean, some of the emails I get from time to time almost make me cry, you know, people telling their stories and saying, you know, before I knew about you guys and got your resources, I didn't know what I was going to do, or my mother didn't know what she was going to do. So, you know, we do have a lot to celebrate. And you know, the good news is we're healthy people. We do all the right things. We're going to be around for a good long time, so we can do this for another 20 years.
Right. So for people who are listening who don't know about Wellness Forum Health and who are interested and want to find out more about the organization and about the conference, where should they go?
They should go to wellnessforum.com, wellnessforumhealth.com, I'm sorry. And there's information, there's a little video of me talking about the conference right on the website. There are forms to fill out, registration forms. If you have questions, you're always welcome to call our office at 614-841-7700. We love talking to people. We're strange folks in that we actually answer the phone and like to have conversation with people. So if you have questions about what's going on or you need help with anything, if you're planning to come, feel free to call the office. But there's quite a bit of information about the conference on the actual website, wellnessforumhealth.com. If you're thinking about it, I've always promised people this. This weekend will change your life. There are not many weekends that change your life, but these weekends have changed my life. The people I know, the things I've learned, the relationships that we have all built with one another, it's absolutely priceless, and the information you're going to get may save your life someday or save the life of somebody who's really close to you.
Great. And what's the dates?
November 4th through 6th in Columbus, Ohio. And by the way, your ticket price includes food, and the meals are amazing. Chef Dell has done an incredible job of teaching the hotel and working with them, and they're great too. I mean, this is the best place we've ever found. They really do know how to make food for people like us, and so you'll enjoy some pretty amazing meals as well.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know, Chef Dell is a repeat guest on this podcast. He's the celebrity chef, right, who's the author of the Forks Over Knives cookbook, Better Than Vegan, China Study Quick and Easy.
And I'm lucky enough to have him as my business partner, so I get to eat that fabulous food every day. So you get to enjoy it for a weekend. I get to enjoy it every day.
and he's a great human being.
He is. And they're all great human beings. We do not bring any not great human beings to Wellness Forum Health, I promise.
Awesome. So, and you know, the other thing is that I have a lot of, you know, clients who live out in the plant-based boondocks where they don't know anybody. And to be able to come to an event like this and find your people, find your community, and have, you know, and learn so much at the same time. Like if you're feeling that gap, this is a great place to, like, you know, you can charge your batteries here for a full year.
Exactly.
And then you can come back next year and do it again.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing you there for sure.
Absolutely. Dr. Pam Popper, thank you so much for masterminding this, for more than 20 years of effort. Let's say we have 20 years of fruit. And thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me. We'll do it again soon, I hope.
Awesome. Take care.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes with links to everything we talked about, including Dr. Campbell's and Seyfried's books and how to register for the Wellness Forum Health Conference at plantyourself.com/178. If you're new to the show, you can catch up on 177 archived episodes over at plantyourself.com. Boy, that sounds like a lot of work. You can pick and choose. If you get the podcast, but not my semi-weekly, sometimes weekly email newsletter, get over to plantyourself.com. You can sign up for that and get lots of other goodies. Big thanks to Plant Yourself podcast patrons Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Brittany Porter, Dominic Morrow, Elizabeth Clifton, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Christine Nielsen, Tina Sharp, Tina Ahern, Jen Vilkanovsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle Eck, Elspeth Feldman, Victoria Dolomanova, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Holt, Josina, and Julianne Rowland for your generous support of the podcast. If you would like to support the show, you can share this and other episodes on social media and via email, and you can write a review on iTunes. I got two beautiful reviews last week. One of them, Waliego, says, my favorite podcast, 5 stars. and simply, Howard is simply unsurpassed. Thank you. And educational inspirational podcast, says Thimble Geek, also 5 stars. Howard Jacobson is the most kind, thoughtful podcast interviewer I've listened to. His interviews draw out morsels of insight from his guests that I think even they didn't realize they had. I have learned from each guest and amassing a huge amount of inspiration and knowledge from them. I hope he does these podcasts forever because I am totally hooked on them. Thank you, Howard. Oh, wow. That is so nice. Yeah, I guess I have to do them forever now because you were so kind in your review. We'll see. But anyway, I'm doing one this week, and I'm doing 2 next week and 2 the week after that, and we'll see how it goes. Also, huge thanks. I'm going to keep him anonymous for now, but somebody wrote to me yesterday and said, you know, your cover art on iTunes, it could be better. And, you know, people write to me all the time and tell me that things could be better, and I'm almost always inclined to agree. But this person actually submitted a design. He created a design for the podcast, and I loved it, and more importantly, my family loved it. And they said it looked much better than the picture of me with a orange bandana shoveling cow shit in the backyard. And so they all agreed that I should change it. And I wrote and I said, well, great, this is beautiful, but, you know, iTunes wants 3,000 by 3,000 pixels. So an hour later, I had 3,000 by 3,000 pixels. So when I get permission to share this person's name with gratitude, I will. But in the meantime, if you happen to be looking at this on iTunes or a device that plays iTunes or Google Play, you will probably see a beautiful new image, the Plant Yourself podcast, with a picture of me with my big headphones and much nicer fonts. So thank you, Mr. Anonymous Graphic Designer. Where was I? So I will be going to the Wellness Forum Health Concert. Concert? You know, I think that that when I did the thank yous, I think I used up all my oxygen. Let's try again. I will be going to the Wellness Forum Health Conference in Columbus, Ohio, February 4th. Jeez, November 4th through 6th, 2016. I look forward to seeing my co-author T. Colin Campbell and meeting Peter Bregan and Tom Seyfried and seeing all my friends, and I would love to see you there as well. If you're interested in the health aspects of a plant-based lifestyle, you know, you go to your doctor and they've never heard of the health effects of a plant-based lifestyle, and they think, you know, lean chicken and egg whites and all that, and olive oil and all that stuff. And just like that, in every other field of medicine, there is the equivalent of a plant-based lifestyle. So you'll find that from Peter Bregan around psychiatry. You'll find that from just all the speakers. There's this other world, research-based, real stuff, not crazy stuff, but real evidence-based stuff that can help you and your loved ones live a better life. And so I'll be there. I'd love to see you there. And you can find out more about that at wellnessforumhealth.com. In garden news, we're kind of bracing for Matthew, hurricane that is now looks like it's doubling down on Florida, and wishing good health and safety to all my friends down there in the Florida, Georgia, South Carolina region and on the coast. And we've got a light rain going here, but so far it's just helping to nourish our garden. So we're hoping that that everyone manages to stay safe and out of harm's way. That's all for this week. As always, be well.